Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. I have two guests on with me, two wonderful young men, Morgan Peckman of Effective New York and Ross Barkin, who writes for the Village Voice. And they're here to kind of talk about what they see as the future of the Democratic and Republican Party in the United States. So, Morgan, why don't you start the conversation since you've done films on politics? What's your view on where both parties are right now?
I would say it's pretty bleak for both parties in terms of the establishment institutional wings of the parties. A lot was talked about, or it was discussed a great deal this last cycle, that the rise of Donald Trump illuminated how hollowed out the Republican Party had become and how it had lost its base and was so easy for an outsider to take over and completely upend the party structure. What was lost in the mix of that narrative to a large degree was the fact that the Democratic Party was so hollowed out, and the ascent of Donald Trump was just as much paved by the fact that the Democratic Party had become so estranged from its base, had lost the faith of its members. And so both parties are going to be in a position where they have to reinvent themselves. Are the Republicans going to go all in with Trumpism and abandon their kind of core conservative principles that have driven the Republican Party for so long? And the Democrats, are they going to go the kind of mainstream route that was represented by Hillary in the primary, or to farther to the left in the camp that was represented by Bernie Sanders?
Ross?
Yes, so I definitely agree with much of what is said. My own views on this are that the Democratic Party at this point is a lot more endangered. I do think there's a road back to power for the Democratic Party. There always is for any party in the minority. But we're at a point right now where Republican dominance of local national government is as great as it's been in over a half century. So while the narrative, as we know, that, you know, Donald Trump, you know, seized the establishment and, you know, proved how maybe ideologically or ineffective the establishment was, you know, you look at the fact that Republicans still control 2/3 of state houses, just about, you know, all these governorships, you know, have a very firm hold of Congress, less firm hold of the Senate, and obviously they have the presidency. So while the Republicans have a lot to sort out, and I do think Donald Trump is probably going to cost them seats in the House and maybe the Senate in 2018, and there will be a backlash against him, the Democrats have a lot of work to do, and the work really starts on the local level, of course, in New York as well with the state Senate, but it's across the country where Democrats are really powerless in many local governments and in many states that, you know, even Hillary won and Obama certainly won twice.
I think that's a good point that Ross makes. The Democrats have been utterly inept in state and local politics across the country. The Koch brothers and Alec and a number of other organized efforts very shrewdly on the Republican side targeted the state houses, targeted the governor's mansions across the state, and the Democrats did not put up a similar organized effort. And that was a real failure of the Obama administration and the Democratic Party under Obama. There was a complacency because they thought it was the demographic destiny that the Democrats would essentially hold the White House in perpetuity. And they dropped the ball in local elections, and the Republicans ran the table. And so their bench is so much deeper now. Their control of the state houses is profound. They are driving national policy through federalism. And Ross is right. I mean, it is a bleak time for the Democrats. And as Ross says, the Democrats could bounce back, but they don't seem to have a plan to do so, and they haven't been very good at pulling off these types of reversals that would certainly be needed if the Democrats are going to regain their standing.
Yeah, and
what is it?
I just want to respond quickly on the Democrats. Also, I was struck by how long it took to elect a new DNC chair, how the election was set for the end of February. It seemed very funny to me that the national organization was virtually leaderless until almost March, two months into the Donald Trump experiment. So I really think that Democrats have to articulate a very clear, concrete vision for winning these seats back. And the party leadership needs to be much more effective. There hasn't really been a good DNC chair in many, many years, maybe going back to Howard Dean. So that's going to be very important if Tom Perez can actually be a party builder and be the dynamic leader that the party desperately craves right now.
Yeah, a lot of the Bernie Sanders people were for Ellison, and the party turned their back on, the grassroots again. So my take, and I could be wrong, is that they're still not listening. What do you think, Morgan?
I mean, I think Ross put his finger on it. Look, and in the wake of Trump's election, the Democrats had no plan B. They were completely caught flat-footed. The institutions, the unions, the powers that be in the establishment Democratic Party had no contingency plan. And they just hoped that, Hillary would get into office and kind of everything would go chugging along and they would piece it back together. That was not the case. They've been in complete disarray, and it's the organic activist movements that we've seen through the Women's March and through the immigration rallies and through all these really grassroots-driven movements, that has filled the void that the Democrats, if they had it together, would have been driving. And so the Democratic establishment, yes, they won the vote with Perez, but that's because that's a vote of the party insiders. And even there, it was neck and neck until the end. I think the Democrats have largely lost the faith of the people who naturally constitute their base and have been supportive of the Democrats in the past. And so, again, just like Debbie Wasserman Schultz could not have been a more tone-deaf and inept DNC leader, I think Tom Perez is a much more savvy and adept person to lead the party. But, he has to work with the tools that are in his toolbox, and they're all, malformed and at this moment. And so he has a real uphill battle, and the Democrats – the Sanders folks and all the other people who have just rebelled against Trumpism and formed this new front of progressivism in America, there's a chance that they will either remake the party or they will find some other avenue to collectively express their outrage at the direction of the country. And the Democrats have been unable to capture that enthusiasm. And, nothing infuriates me more than, Trump loses and then you just get Trump wins and then you get these DNC emails like, give money to our congressional candidates so that 2 years from now we can flip the House of Representatives. It's like, this isn't a fundraising push, right? This is a profound ideological battle within the party, and it's one that necessitates clear direction, the type of direction that Ross was talking about. And we have not seen the Democrats put forward such a platform. And keeping people like Nancy Pelosi as the minority leader, you know, just, again, shows the in the extreme tone deafness of the Democratic Party.
Well, I've been struck, too, by the wariness of some Democrats to embrace the activist wing. And I understand, you know, if you're a moderate or a centrist, the Bernie approach is a bit off-putting. At the same time, as Morgan said, this is where the energy of the party is. And you saw in 2010 with the Tea Party wave really driving this Republican takeover. And with the Democrats, it's odd. I mean, you even saw the Perez-Ellison race, and we know it was a battle of party insiders, and Perez barely beat Ellison. But the question was, why was Tom Perez in this race to begin with? I mean, who was calling for Tom Perez to lead the DNC? And the answer was, it was Obama acolytes. It was people close to Hillary. It wasn't anyone, you know, outside of the party infrastructure. I mean, the actual activist push was with Keith Ellison, but at the end of the day, because, you know, that this was the nature of the election, Perez was able to win, and he may end up being a great party leader. I don't know yet. But it's just funny to me that you're coming off what I would say is one of the more catastrophic election losses for Democrats in many years, and given the weaknesses of Trump and kind of the years in the making that the Hillary candidacy was. I mean, this was a true failure across the board. And so there's been a lack of a reckoning with that among establishment Democrats, at least as I see it. I'm still waiting for an autopsy report, like the RNC produced after 2012. And we know that autopsy report didn't end up being entirely prescient because Trump disregarded it and still won. At the same time, the fact that the Republican Party under Priebus was really looking inward and examining their weaknesses is something I'm still waiting for the DNC to do, for Democratic leaders to do. And instead, you know, there's just this belief that, you know, the election was stolen. It was all Russians. It was all WikiLeaks, and, you know, wipe our hands of it. But it was much more complicated than that. And it's strange to me that more Democrats don't see that.
I think rank-and-file Democrats don't see it, but you're right. The party establishment has no grasp of the necessity for that.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that Donald Trump owns the Republican Party lock, stock, and barrel?
I mean, as of now, he's the leader of the party, so yes, that will probably change. I think it always gets harder for a president as time goes along and, you know, controversies build up and, you know, the Congress starts to see and feel out where they can push back on the executive. So I think at this moment, Trump still has a lot of leverage and a lot of power because the Republican base is with him and there's a contingent of Republicans who will always support him no matter what. And of course, his approval ratings aren't very good, and they may fall much more. I don't quite know what's going to happen, but I would say as of this moment, yes. I mean, he is the Republican Party, but if there is a real damaging scandal or he continues to have setbacks, you can see, you know, more traditional Republicans assert themselves, you know, as a block, not just as individuals like we've seen with John McCain or some others. You know, you may see a more concerted effort to question or combat him. But as of now, it's definitely his party.
What I found very interesting was in the election, the base was for Trump, but the Republican leaders were not for Trump. They really were kind of leery of him. And on the flip side, the base for the Democratic Hillary Clinton, the base really didn't like her, but the party elite really embraced her. So it was like, you know, different parts of the spectrum. I found that really interesting. What do you think?
You know, I mean, look, Hillary Clinton was a nominee that was force-fed to the party, and the party rebelled against it. Certainly the Sanders rise was just as much about him as it was a response to an unwillingness of people to be force-fed a nominee. The Republicans had a far more competitive primary, at least structurally, and that's how they could arrive at a nominee that could actually unite the voters. But I wanted to get back to your to what Ross was saying. You know, this election really revealed how soulless the Republican Party is. You know, the Republican Party puts on this pretense of ideology and being driven by these core principles, but what we really saw was that their goal was to win. And once it was clear that, you know, Trump was the standard bearer, all the people who had been wringing their hands and so appalled by his antics and the horrible things that he was saying and his destruction of party orthodoxy, they all got in line. And when he won the presidency, everybody was like only too willing to put aside their principles in service of the agenda of the Republicans running the show. And so in terms of Donald Trump being the head of the party, I think it's very tenuous, right? Because if the agenda is only to go with the person who you think is going to help you win, if Trump's poll numbers crater and we fall into recession and all the grandiose promises of making America great again are manifestly not being realized and the public turns against Trump, he will lose the party in a heartbeat, because the Ryan folks and McConnell folks and all them will just turn the ship in a different direction. And, you know, one of the real tests for the Republican Party this last primary season was, would Paul Ryan make the principled stand that he was setting himself up to make? Would these stalwarts of the conservative ideology that has dominated the party for so long, would they draw a line in the sand? Well, they didn't. They all caved. And so since they're so malleable in their principles, if Donald Trump is no longer the winning team, they will jump ship in a moment.
Ross?
Yeah, it's definitely true that it's all contingent on Trump and his success. And so it's a party of one right now. And if it becomes clear that Trump is a liability for Republicans, the so-called establishment types will desert him entirely. But as long as Trump remains popular in Republican congressional districts in particular, I think Paul Ryan is always going to have a hard time really asserting himself against Trump if he wants to do that, because many of the rank and file members have to deal with people back home who are very supportive of the president. So that's going to be interesting to see at what point does that division make itself evident. And some of that may come down to the battle over the self-care law. And this is very important for Trump and very important for the Republican Party and for the Democratic Party and obviously for everyone else. So, you know, I already see this as an early turning point. And, you know, if this bill goes nowhere, if some version of this bill becomes law, it's going to be very fascinating to see how that reveals or further papers over divisions in the party.
You know, I know Donald Trump, you know, has tons of money where he almost self-funded the campaign by himself. If he were to succeed, does that tell anybody at any level of government, you don't have to move up through the party structure? You can just crash the party and you know, make a name for yourself. What do you think?
Well, it's inaccurate that he largely self-funded his campaign. He certainly did initially, but, you know, he didn't put anywhere near the total amount of money into his campaign that it ultimately spent, nor did he have the financial resources to put $500 million into a campaign. But that being said, I mean, we've already seen, and, you know, maybe this is just media scuttlebutt, but the a lot of people who enjoy immense celebrity and have the resources to break to grab the media spotlight be interested in the presidency in a way that they never were before, because it was thought that you actually had to have some sort of accomplishments in politics prior to running for office. Trump smashed that mold. And, you know, it will be a new paradigm. There will be celebrities every cycle who will eye the White House in a different way than they did before. Whether any of them really jump into the mix, that remains to be seen. But, you know, we've already heard about Howard Schultz and Oprah Winfrey and, you know, a whole host of people who would, you know, be able to command the media's attention, or Mark Zuckerberg be interested in the White House. And, you know, it's certainly not off the table. We've seen how powerful celebrity is in this world of social media and the 24-hour news cycle, where somebody who is really has only superficial or tenuous claim to being able to do anything in the political sphere can command the attention of the media and drive public attention.
And I would add to that, we've seen celebrity politicians before, with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jesse Ventura in California and Minnesota. This is unique because it was done on the presidential level, which we've never seen. You know, we've been in this era of celebrity politics for a while. You know, you could even date it back to the emergence of JFK as, you know, young, handsome, you know, glamorous senator with, you know, a rather thin record, and go from there. But this is very unique and unprecedented, the way Trump sees the presidency. One mistake future candidates will probably make, future celebrity candidates will make, is assuming that because they're famous or because they can command media attention, this will make them viable candidates. Trump either accidentally or intuitively or brilliantly, however you want to describe it, was able to tap into a real vein in the Republican base and find a core of support around his message very quickly. Now, a lot of these celebrity candidates who've been bandied about, we know Zuckerberg or Winfrey or Mark Cuban, Kanye West, you know, the question is what party would they run in, and, you know, what sort of message will they offer to really appeal to a segment of the base of either party. And if they're going to be, you know, a milquetoast centrist like maybe a Michael Bloomberg, there's really no path forward for you. You have to either be a rich, you know, maybe left-wing populist, if such a thing exists, or, you know, maybe tap into some segment of the Republican base or be able to consolidate some segment of that base. Otherwise, you know, you'll be like a Ross Perot or a Bloomberg, where, you know, you're floating out there and some people like you and the media thinks you're interesting, but there's really no viable way forward.
That's a good point by Ross. You know, one of the maxims that Roger Stone, you know, who's a top advisor to the president, lives by, and that Trump clearly does as well, is that you have to be outrageous to get noticed. And whereas the conventional wisdom thought that Trump being outrageous would destroy his candidacy because it was so unorthodox, it actually completely inured to his benefit because it kept the media enthralled by him. It caught the public's attention. It was a dog whistle to the people who needed to hear the dog whistle. I mean, it really made him stand out among a bunch of really bland, middle of the road, standard Republicans. And when you saw him on stage in the debates, he lit them all up. And so it's not just enough to be a celebrity. You need to be able to leverage that celebrity with your message to get maximum attention. And so what Ross is saying, I think, is absolutely right. You know, just kind of coming in and being like, oh, I'm going to be the great unifier, and here's a bunch of empty platitudes that have been tested by my consultants. I don't think that's going to be a very effective strategy. It will have to be somebody who comes in as a bomb thrower from one direction or another.
Do you think that Trump has devalued politics, Morgan?
I mean, I don't even know what that means. Politics, I mean, he played, you know, by so many of the traditional, maxims of politics. I mean, politics is blood sport. You destroy your opponents to win. There's never a time of this highfalutin idealized politics. Those days of this halcyon era that we long for never existed. We've seen Reagan and Nixon and LBJ and JFK I'll resort to tactics that were absolutely appalling from an ethical standpoint, from the standpoint of fair play, but they didn't receive the same scrutiny that Trump's did. Now, Trump did amp it up to a different level, but, I mean, we can look back at many, many eras in time where leaders did things far more egregious, far more murdered their opponents, murdered their opposition, enslaved people. I mean, there's never been a time that politics has been, all the wine and roses.
Ross?
Very, very true. You go back, to reading some stories about, politics in the 19th century and, how blatantly corrupt, local political machines were, and also, national politics with stuffing ballot boxes and, making character assassinations. And then, of course, into the 20th century, we know with the 1960 election with John F. Kennedy in Chicago, and the belief that there may have been, irregularities there. And of course, LBJ too. I know, and I haven't read the Carroll biography, but from just hearing about it, that in his early races, there were some dubious tactics that were employed to ensure that he would win in Texas. So,
just outright stole those races.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, I would say the difference today is that we are in this era of, 24-hour cable news and of, celebrity politics and maybe, the idea that, being outrageous alone as Trump was can really seize the imagination of cable networks and really control the narrative utterly with the way Trump did in the primaries, having so far more airtime than everyone else. So that's something that's a development that I do find upsetting. But at the same time, I agree. There's never a moment of purity for American politics. It was always very, very messy business. And, it was always about, out of this muck some good would come, and as we've seen over the years, that you can produce good policy outcomes even from untoward politics. And of course, you can get some very bad policy outcomes too from bad politics.
As this administration evolves, I'd like to have both of you back on Focus on Albany to share your thoughts on what you feel is going on. So you've been listening to Morgan Peckman, Effective New York, and Ross Barkin, who writes for the Village Voice. If you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes, and if you have a comment, hashtag Focus on Albany and share your thoughts. Thanks, guys. Have a wonderful weekend and happy St. Patrick's Day. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Bye.